From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we have more new Apple stuff to talk about because Apple cannot stop launching things. There's Oprah, there's credit cards, and a billion pockets, y'all. Later on, I will chat with author and professor Cal Newport about his book, Digital Minimalism, and all the ways he wants to help us reset our relationship with technology. But before we get to good things about technology, let's talk about Apple. Here with me, as always, my fellow tech columnists Joanna Stern and Christopher Mims, and here with me in the studio with a surprisingly large stack of paper, our Apple reporter, Trip Mickle. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
So, Joanna and Christopher, you didn't get to be there at this lovely event in which a parade of famous people told us about TV shows they haven't made yet. But I want to know what it was like to watch this event that Apple had where it launched all the services that everybody's been talking about for like 2 years. Joanna, you're usually at these events, but what was it like to watch these things from afar?
I was so comfortable. I had a burrito bowl from Chipotle, not sponsored here, but maybe if you guys want to sponsor the podcast, we'll be willing to listen.
I'm down.
And I was watching in the comfort of my own office, and I could hear it on big loudspeakers, and it was great.
So you weren't sitting in the incredibly uncomfortable leather chairs.
Yeah, I mean, why do you care? I want to hear about your experience. You were in the room with Oprah and Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston and Tim Cook.
Did they stop for selfies after?
No. So ordinarily at these events, when there are interesting people, they like sort of float around a little bit. And even before, like we saw, Trip, you saw the CEO of Goldman Sachs and like a couple of other semi-interesting folks who were running around. But we had the sense that there were going to be like A-listers here, and they were nowhere to be found.
Not only were there not A-listers there, but pretty much everybody from Hollywood who was in town was secreted away into the auditorium. They weren't even out in the main area upstairs before we were ushered downstairs. They came in from some other area of the facility.
They just helicoptered in, I'm sure, and just like rolled out on stage and then back in their helicopters and left.
Yeah, it was weird. It was like almost like they didn't want the Hollywood people who had come into town, roughly about 300 people, to intermingle at all with the Silicon Valley tech press that was assembled there to cover and report on the event.
I think you mean riffraff.
They're not allowed to talk to the famous people.
Yeah,
right.
Whatever you want to call us.
Yeah. So this event was like very unlike your average Apple event, which are normally lists of hardware products or software that works on those hardware products. This was services. And I kept waiting for Apple to come up with a better word than services, and they just didn't. Instead, they said the word services 100 million times in the course of this one event.
Let's take a look at our services in action. With our services, communication services, we provide services and services.
You've been reporting on all this stuff forever, Trip, and like they were going to work on TV stuff, they were going to work on gaming stuff, they launched a credit card. Super high level, we're a couple of days out from this now. Like, what was this event about for Apple? Why did they do this now?
Apple has hit a point in the lifespan of the iPhone where they're just not selling as many iPhones as they used to. We all know about this. We all recall in early January when they had to slash their guidance for the first time in 16 years. I mean, these are unprecedented actions that they've had to take as a consequence of the pressure on the iPhone business. And in the face of that, what they've decided to do is build all of these adjacent businesses around the iPhone that are piggybacking on the iPhone so that they can find revenue growth in the face of all this pressure. I think this one stat from this past week really resonated with me, and that came from Tony Sakanagi at Bernstein. He said that Apple is expected to have $25 billion less in revenue for 2019 than they did a year ago.
Wow.
And that just underscores the hole that they face, and they've got to find new revenue streams to make up for that gap.
So, but they're still in this really interesting position where they have, it's like Oprah said, a billion pockets. Like they've sold tons of these devices, and the problem is there aren't that many new ways to sell to those people who already have Apple devices. But they've sold so many. So now, I mean, I guess it seems like sort of a natural question. It's like, how do we make more money off of you after you've already bought a bunch of our products? And one of them is like headphones and watches, but the other one is sell them things to do on all these devices, right? Like that seems like a fairly straightforward sort of next step, right?
Exactly. And what is selling those services also do for you? It shores up the iPhone business, right?
True.
Because right now, if you think about Spotify, Netflix, all of the apps that we use all the time, they become so popular and so powerful that it doesn't really matter what device you access them from, whether it's your Echo speaker at home or your Google Assistant or your Chromecast or a Fire Stick or Roku or whatever, you pretty much have the same experience. And that's kind of a challenge for the iPhone, right?
Right.
This was the sleek hardware-software integration that was what powered the iPhone to the great heights and successes that it enjoyed. So what do? You build some of your own apps that make sure people stick with the Apple world as other apps kind of challenge the time you spend on your iPhone.
If we take a step back, we should probably review what they announced this week, but my question
really...
Yeah,
we're going to go through.
Okay, because my follow-up question to that is, I want us all to say how many of these would pay Apple for in a month?
Vote with our voices?
I think so. I think we just each say the number. But maybe we should do this in reverse order. We should just say what they announced.
Let's do that. So let's start with, let's just go
David,
through
organize
in order.
Us.
So
can you organize
the first
us, David?
The first thing they announced was Apple News Plus. Joanna, explain what Apple News Plus is.
Of course. I'm the one that has to explain this odd odd thing.
I'm on it right now.
The good news is they're all impossible. So
okay, Apple News Plus is a news subscription service. Instead of the normal Apple News, you pay $10 a month and you get access to 300 plus magazines. Did I get that number right? I think it's that. I think that's right.
Yep.
300 plus magazines.
I think it's like 304 or something like that. It's very close to 300.
Good fact check.
Yeah.
And then you can also get newspapers. And there is the LA Times. And then there's also this other one called the Wall Street Journal.
Never heard of it.
We're not technically on there yet, are we?
Oh, yeah, we are.
Can't find us. We'll look later.
Yeah. Yes, you can find us. We're right there.
I'm searching right now. Continue.
So Mims doesn't read the Wall Street Journal, as we've learned. So that's good to know. It's $10 a month. And it feels like there's a bunch of other stuff. But the main thrust is like read issues of magazines. Right? Like that seemed to be the thing they talked the most about. It was Wyatt Mitchell, their design director, in like a super rad white jumpsuit reading magazines.
Okay.
And in talking with somebody ahead of this, one of the reasons there's this emphasis on magazines is they're long articles. They take time to read. You're more engaged to get back to my point earlier, you're more engaged inside Apple and an Apple app
right.
if you're reading a longer article. And that was something that they were pretty deliberate about. That's why they saw magazines as a key vehicle for them. Plus, it fits in with the whole like design, art, photography, aesthetic of Apple as well.
Do you think our editors
think
will let
use...
us write longer?
Oh, God. No.
Definitely not.
I see our editor right now shaking his head at me.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's about right.
Wait, to that point, though, I love trotting this out. There was an earnings call like more than a year ago where some muckety muck at Amazon said, it doesn't matter that we don't make money on video. We have found that people who watch our videos stick around on the site more and shop more. So to your point, reinforcing your point, Trip, about getting people to engage with their devices more, that still doesn't explain why Apple's taking a 50% cut on the subscription revenue they're taking from this, but I guess they need to satisfy Wall Street as well.
Yeah, I mean, you stop selling iPhones, you got to make money somehow. But okay, so that's one thing. And then on exactly the same token, giving you like more stuff to do on your device was, I think the next one was Apple Arcade, right? Which is game subscriptions, basically. Trip, you get to explain this one. This one's slightly easier than the News Plus.
Apple has gone out and cut agreements with game developers, essentially paid game developers up front to develop 100-plus games for a subscription service that they haven't disclosed what they're going to charge for, but you'll have unlimited access to the games that they curate and provide through Apple Arcade.
Which, personally, this is the one that makes the most sort of obvious sense to me as like any kid who wants to play games on iPads instead of paying, $2, $3, $5, $10 a piece, you just pay some monthly fee and you get to play tons of games. Like that seems like a win for a lot of people.
I think that one of the big areas of emphasis too, if you go back and look at the segment, was on the family aspect of it, right?
Mm.
And I don't have somebody tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, can I get a couple more bucks? I got to buy another life in this game.
Right.
But if you had a kid and somebody was tapping you on the shoulder saying, can I get a couple more bucks? Like, what better way to address that than just paying, say, hypothetically $10 a month, and then you just don't get pestered?
Yeah, I mean, the stories about the kids running up crazy in-app purchase bills on their parents' iPads or whatever, it's like they're wild. Okay, so that's the one. And then Mims, you get the single worst job of all of us, which is to explain what, if I'm counting correctly, was like 14,000 different versions of Apple TV and TV apps and channels and TVs and other things.
Do you want to
Let's
do
see
it
what I can do here. Somebody called it cable box, but for streaming. And then other people said, Comcast also offers that. So they are going to offer you, I am not sure whose content beyond their own, since there was such an emphasis on their originals, and it'll be on Apple TV and it'll be on all of your devices. Oh, and also you can get it on Roku and all the other streaming boxes. What did I miss?
That was a pretty solid setup. Well, what was weird was
Well, the thing is, I didn't really understand what you said, but I don't think I understand anything that Apple said.
Okay, Trip is looking at me like he's got this.
I had to write this and then have a debate with my editor about this. But essentially,
or maybe we should each just say what we think they announced and we're all wrong. And then
we're all wrong.
No. Okay, Trip, go.
But essentially, they're offering a la carte subscriptions. They're taking their existing TV app that they rolled out in 2016, and they're trying to make it easier for people to subscribe immediately and with one password and almost one click to Showtime, Stars, HBO, etc. So they're just trying to bring all that stuff together.
Like a bunch of nonsense that most people don't actually want. They put up this slide of all the different channels you can subscribe to, and there are like, I don't know, 30 of them. And I recognized like five.
Yeah, I only recognized two.
This is clearly not
HBO and
every
Showtime.
Channel on cable yet. It's three premium channels, and you kind of get what they're going for, but this is not
I listened to the presentation. This is like really the first time I've even really understood this.
This is good. Okay,
good.
Sorry, keep
good.
Going.
I'm doing
so
well.
That was one piece.
And I've read all your articles, Trip, too, frankly.
Good. I'm glad somebody does. And then they have TV Plus, right, which is going to be their own original programming, and that's going to be – they haven't said what they're going to charge for it. Again, this is a bit of a recurring theme from that day. But that's going to be a little bit of the honey, if you will, to kind of get the bees to come in, check out some programming, and then maybe buy some HBO and Showtime, and they'll make money off of that as well. And it'll all be living inside one app, and that's the TV app that, again, they tried to release in 2016, but just didn't seem to resonate with people. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking about it all over again.
Yeah, well, so what's weird is I found out talking to a bunch of people right before the event that there are lots of people who have no idea that the TV app exists. And what's weird is, so there's Apple TV, the box. There's Apple TV, there's TV, which is the name of an app made by Apple, which you could, I guess, also call Apple TV. Then there's TV channels, which is this thing where you can subscribe to HBO and Stars and Showtime and whatever else. And then there's TV Plus, which is all their original content, which is, you know, where Oprah and Jennifer Aniston and all those people who they trotted out on stage to tell us about their shows come in. And so it's like, on the one hand, it's a lot of things. But on the other hand, it's just this kind of like mush of stuff that doesn't necessarily add up to all that much yet for people.
And the one thing we think they'll charge for is TV Plus, right? Like that would be the $10 a month that you pay for our exclusive new content with Oprah and Steve Carell and all these famous people. The rest
they'll
is like
charge
free-ish.
Not really. They'll charge directly for TV Plus, right? That money,
right.
say you pay $10 a month for that, that will go directly to Apple.
Right.
Say you pay $10 for Showtime a month, that will also go to Apple, but they'll have to carve out, let's just say, based on the first year subscription, $7 of that and send it to Showtime.
Got it. Yes. Sorry. But directly to that we pay for Apple will be their content.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea seems to be, and like I buy the overarching idea, which is that like you subscribe to, there are lots of things in lots of places, and it's helpful to have one bill and one interface. And so it's like, if you could pull all of my stuff on Hulu and Netflix and HBO and live TV and ESPN and whatever else into one place and help me sort through it all, that would be awesome. But this is not that. This is like a gesture towards that, but they don't have Netflix. It's like, if you don't have Netflix, you've done nothing for me. I don't know. So it's like I get the idea, but it just doesn't seem like this seems like the same thing Apple has been trying and failing to do for a very long time.
Well, the funny thing is I actually for a long time, and I might still, I don't think I am anymore, I ended up subscribing to Netflix through the App Store, right? And so my sign on for Netflix for a long time was actually my Apple ID. I don't know if it is anymore, but basically,
you just felt
this
like spending more
thing.
Money on Netflix.
So no, it was always the same Apple amount. Too. It was the same amount. It was $9 or whatever it was
oh,
at the time.
Oh,
$10.
Spotify that used to be more expensive because if you subscribe to the App Store, I was.
But like,
that.
It really is kind of the same thing, right? This is just putting it more in your face and then trying to like tell us that it's going to be easier to have the same password or whatever.
Right. And I do think, I mean, it's, we were talking about this, that like the thrust of it seems to be that they really believe that people hate entering usernames and passwords and credit card information. And that if they can prevent you from having to do that, then your life will be so much better that you will do all your business through this one company. And you only have to know one username and password and you never have to enter your credit card information and everything will just be wonderful. Like, I get that, but I don't know if that's so compelling that I'm going to throw my whole life into Apple devices just to make this work.
Right.
I don't know.
Okay, so let's do it. Let's each say how many we would pay for and which ones.
Okay, so and the ground rules here are we're going to assume that there are four services. There's games, news, TV, and channels, we'll just call it. And they're each $10 a month. So you have up to $40 a month to spend here.
Also add in here, because just for the purpose of this, let's add in music and iCloud, because those are other services that Apple offers every month. And I wanted to, then we can do a tally of like how much we'd pay Apple every month and how long it would take them to recoup the sales of an iPhone.
All right. I'm in. Joanna, you go first. How many would you pay for?
I think I'd pay for three. I'd pay for Apple TV Plus. I do pay for music. And I play for iCloud. Those are the three I pay for.
All right. Christopher, what about you?
News, maybe games for my kids, and iCloud.
Three. All right, okay.
News Plus.
You already get the journal content.
That's
for
it.
Free.
That's it. That's the only one. All right.
Yeah, but I'm like one of those weird people that likes to stand in front of a magazine rack, like Tim Cook was talking about. I spent hours looking at all the magazines I could read yesterday.
You'd never know it to look at him, but Tripp is 74 years old.
Yeah. And he doesn't use cloud storage. He has giant hordes of external hard drives at his house.
Right. He has paper in front of him right now. It's all in file folders. I think my answer, I'm definitely going to end up paying for TV Plus because there's a show with Steve Carell in it and it's just a personal belief that I will pay for anything that gets me Steve Carell content. Probably iCloud just because it makes some things about using an iPhone more convenient to pay for a little. But I kind of think that's it. I like Spotify better. I already have a Roku that does all the stuff. That's fine. News that I can buy a magazine when I'm getting on a plane. I don't know.
Is that because Field & Stream is only rendered in PDFs?
Yeah. If they would really just update the format, I'd be happy again.
Also, Highlights. Highlights yes. Magazine for kids is available there, and it's just PDFs.
Oh, well, that's worth the $10 a month already.
Mm-hmm. So, Tripp, this is what I want to ask you. So even if you figure here that, and I did some back-of-the-napkin math here, that each of those services we just mentioned are $10 a month, right? My three services, I think a couple of us said three, right? So that's around $360 a year, right? Mm-hmm. That would take, I know there's a lot of complicated math behind the scenes here about how much money Apple takes or whatever, but it would be in 3 years, $360 for 3 years, that's $1,000 in 3 years. That's the price of an iPhone. Is this what they're doing?
Yeah.
And you've already bought an iPhone. Don't forget. This right. all comes with the fact that you've already bought an iPhone. Okay, so we should quickly talk about the other quote-unquote service that Apple announced, which I think most people would just call a credit card. This credit card is called Apple Card, and it lives on your phone, and it also has sort of a nifty budgeting and tracking app into it. But they did make a cool-looking titanium card that has like no numbers on it and is definitely going to be the cool new credit card in Silicon Valley in 5 minutes. This was also the thing that I heard the most excitement about coming out of the event because maybe it was just like the only thing that felt real. I don't know. But you've been reporting on this forever, Tripp. Like you've been talking to people about how this was coming for a long time. So why would Apple want to make a credit card? Two things that could not be more different are the company Apple that people like and credit card companies.
One point on this, by the way, and just the reaction of people like, and the fact that it's March and you're a Virginia fan, the credit card was like the 12 seed of the day, right? Like, it was a dark horse. It was well coached. It came out. It did all the fundamental stuff it had to do, and it really won. Like it really did. And it surprised everybody.
It's a sports joke?
That was a March Madness
analogy,
joke.
But
oh,
yeah. I can tell it was a real winner with you, Joanna.
Joanna loves sports. It's the most important thing to know about Joanna.
Did you get the joke?
In its outline, yeah. I could tell by the modulation of their voices that it was supposed to be a joke.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Oh, wow.
This is the people we choose to spend our time with. But okay, so And the idea was, it was really interesting to me the way they presented it, because they went a long time without even acknowledging that there is a physical credit card. Like, its primary existence is supposed to be in the wallet app on your devices. And they talked a lot about how, you know, Apple Pay is lots of places and you're going to be able to use it on transit in some cities in the U.S. And it's designed to be a digital thing. Like, the rewards are even better if you use the same card on your phone versus swiping it, right?
Because they want to build Apple Pay. They want to increase right. Apple Pay use. If you go back to 2017, 3 years after they'd introduced Apple Pay, they still hadn't really cracked the code, in part because there were so many gaps in terms of where you could use it. I mean, we've all had that experience where you walk into a store and you're like, does this place take Apple Pay? Does it not? You have to ask the cashier. It was a point of friction. They want to remove that and make it ubiquitous.
Mims, Joanna, did this excite either of you?
I'm really into the card. It looks so nice.
Did you like the video where it was like the beautiful machining? It was like the Apple-iest video about a credit card that
I mean,
I've ever
I have
seen.
A Chase Sapphire card, and I love that it's not plastic.
Do we think that over under that Joni Ive himself designed that card? It's
that's what I was about to ask. Like, who got this assignment and ID? Was it the intern or was it?
But Mims, are you going to do your impression?
I don't know. We had to rethink the credit card from the ground up. I just picture him talking over that classic.
Did you just
video
make him like an
them?
Eastern European supervillain? I feel like you just did. That was awesome.
I can't do Joni Ive. Sorry. Today he's Australian.
Also, I love that you call him Joni. Like Joni Mitchell Ive.
Like Joni Mitchell.
I found it interesting that the one segment that he did do a voiceover for was actually the arcade and gaming segment and not the video for the card design itself. So they must have at least had some appreciation internally. I'm just speculating here.
I was actually genuinely confused because I thought, oh, the maker of this game has the voice that sounds like Joni Ive when I first started watching that. I was like, that's so weird.
Every designer just sounds like Joni Ive, basically. They all learn how to do impressions when you're in design school. But no, I mean, the thing about the credit card that gets me is that it does seem like the pitch is very sort of Apple-y in the sense that they're like, forget all these budgeting apps you're worrying about, forget about. Like, they put up a slide of like a complicated looking credit card bill that didn't look that complicated. But then we're like, we'll tell you what these lines mean about which coffee shop you were at. And I was like, well, it already said the name of the coffee shop in that. But their pitch is like, we'll make this simpler and easier. And it's very much like a make life easier for young people who don't understand how to balance checkbooks kind of thing, which I guess going to be compelling to a lot of people.
I thought like, that stuff was cool, actually. I mean, mostly because I thought Apple there could offer the convenience. Like, most credit cards let you do that right now. You can go see a lot of that breakdown in an American Express app or a Chase app, but it's hard to get to. You have to put in your password like 70 times. I thought, okay, this is what Apple could bring to the table here. I would be interested in that.
We have to recognize that this is like, it's merely a stake in the ground, right? Like, they have to roll out this whole thing. It all has to work. None of it can fail. If there's any security breaches, it's a complete nightmare. So I am speculating that this is like a tenth of the roadmap they have for this. Like, they are going to build this monstrous iMessage integrated every app, every website, every physical payment point enhancing experience, you know, once they're sure that it's working, because it's all software, right? It's not like with the watch where it's like, oh, we got to add a new capability, we need more battery life, more sensors. Like, once they have people on this card, they can do, you know, every dumb Bitcoin or blockchain pitch we've ever gotten, like, they can go do that, right? Because at the end of the day, those are all just a database in the cloud somewhere. So I just think that if they can get some traction, they will just add more and more features.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, okay, and so speaking of iMessage, before we go here, I'm curious about one other thing, which is that Apple kind of did the most cross-platform thing it's ever done by rolling out or announcing TV apps across Roku and Fire TV and a bunch of other smart TVs, which Apple historically does not do.
And arguably, you could say the credit card, too. The physical credit card is an acknowledgement. Like, we've got to fill in gaps.
Right. Like, a world exists outside of Apple products that people live in. Should we take this as a sign that, like, is iMessage coming to Android? Should we take this as a sign that the world is about to get a little more connected for Apple people?
Yeah. And AirPower is coming, and they fixed the MacBook keyboards.
Yeah, everything's wonderful now.
Everything's wonderful now.
Oprah told Tim Cook to just fix it. Now everything's fine.
Apple! There it is.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Well, all right. Trip has to go, like, do his job.
What if Oprah uses an Android phone?
I want to get to a new segment we're doing on the show, which we're going to call Today I Learned. So every week, one of us is going to bring some weird or cool or interesting thing that we learned that isn't going to make it into a story or video or any of the reporting that we're doing. First up, Joanna, you have been complaining on this podcast, I think since the beginning, about your MacBook keyboard, and you finally have some solutions for people. So tell us what you have this week.
I learned that my MacBook Air keyboard is broken. My column this week was about how the third generation of Apple's Butterfly keyboard is still broken, even after three generations. And I also learned that Apple is sorry about that. They're sorry. They said in a statement to me, and I'll read aloud, even though this is not, this is something I learned. They say, let me pull this up here, that we are aware that a small number of users are having issues with their third generation Butterfly keyboard, and for that we are sorry. The vast majority of Mac notebook users are having a positive experience with the new keyboard. And then they suggest that you go to the Apple Store to get your keyboard fixed if you're one of these people. So I learned a couple of things about what to do if you do have a Butterfly keyboard. For those that have had issues like me, the issues that I have are either I'll press on the E, well, now it's already spread to my W key. It's the E, R, and W keys. If I press it, it doesn't always work. Sometimes I press it and I get double letters. Sometimes it just feels like it's stuck. So if you have these problems, you should go to the Apple Store immediately. You should run there. They will likely replace it for free. They will likely try to tell you they cleaned it out first and then send you away. And then if you still have the problem, you'll come back and they'll replace the whole keyboard free of charge. The biggest tip I think that you can do is you can get this Unshaky keyboard, this Unshaky app. A developer made this app because he was also noticing the repeats of keys. So he made this app where you install the app. It's called Unshaky. There's a link to it in my column. And if it senses a second key press, because sometimes what happens here is you press on the key and it kind of gets stuck. So that's why you see two repeats of the key. It will kill.
But like instantly, right?
Instantly,
It only
yes.
happens within like milliseconds. Yeah.
It kills. So what it does is it senses if there is that second key press and kills any press of a key that occurs within a millisecond of the first. So you can actually set in this program the seconds. It's pretty amazing because it works really well. Other things you can do is you can clean your keyboard. You can buy a can of air. Somebody joked to me on Twitter that they should sell the Air, MacBook Air, with a can of air. But that is actually what they should do.
But it would be like $49 if you bought it from Apple.
It's true. The last thing is you could just get another laptop. That's another thing I learned.
Is that realistic?
No. It really isn't.
That's good. I like it. All right. And now we're going to switch gears completely. Apple would really like to give you more to do on your devices, not type so much on them, apparently, but do stuff on them, watch things. But author and professor Cal Newport really, really, really wants you to do a whole lot less.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Welcome back. I think over the last year, a lot of people have started to rethink how they use their gadgets. I've had this sort of nagging sense for a while that I use my phone too much, but I don't really know why, and I don't really know what to do about it. All I have is this sense that using my phone makes me feel bad too, but I can't even figure out why or what to do about it. Cal Newport has some ideas. He's a computer science professor at Georgetown, but also the author of several books, most recently one called Digital Minimalism. In the book, he makes the case that the problem is not that we use social media and technology too much, but that we use it too thoughtlessly. It's not Instagram that sucks. It's the constant casual scrolling and feeling bad about yourself when you'd rather be doing other things. So Cal recommends, among other things, doing a 30-day decluttering in which you ditch any technology that's not absolutely critical to the everyday function of your life, which he says is basically all technology and social media. He had hundreds of people go through this experiment while he was writing his book and found some pretty remarkable things. I've now read Digital Minimalism twice, and it rings really true to me, mostly anyway. So I called Cal to help me understand better what he's thinking about. And we started with a point that he makes early on in the book, which I hadn't really considered before, that all these sites, Facebook and Instagram and the rest, didn't actually start out to be the attention-sucking everything machines they currently are. They started to be something else.
This thing that we're familiar with today, this constant companion model where you always look at your phone, the thing that's giving people unease, the thing that makes people feel like they're losing their autonomy, I'm always looking at this phone and it's taking me away from things that are more valuable. That was largely driven by the social media companies reinventing their products. And Facebook took the lead here in order to get their product numbers up so that the IPO would be successful. They went through this huge reengineering where it changed from 2005 Facebook, which was really about you post things, my friends post things, we look at each other's post. It was just a web 2.0 vision with an easier interface. It shifted from that and they changed it into something where you were receiving this ongoing stream of social approval indicators. So likes and comments and tags and photos, and that every time you tapped on the app on your phone, you could see, do I get some more of these social approval indicators? And sometimes you get a lot and sometimes you don't get that many. So it's intermittent. So it's a reward that we really cared about, indications that other people are thinking about you. And it was arriving intermittently, which we know hijacks the dopamine system in a way that makes us pull that proverbial slot machine lever a lot more than we should. It was actually that reengineering, which completely changed the experience, completely deviated what's happening with these social media companies from the web 2.0 sort of utopian model from which they were birthed in the early 2000s. And it's what got us to this point where we began looking at our phones all the time.
I feel like the blame for that goes on both sides, though, right? I mean, without smartphones as they evolved, especially after the iPhone, that we wouldn't have had the sort of surfaces and platforms.
So for Jobs, the iPhone was, this is going to be a much better phone than you've ever had. It's going to be in one elegant box, so you don't have to have two different devices in your pocket, which he thought was quite inelegant. I went back and talked to the development lead of the original iPhone. He confirmed this. Yeah, this was an iPod that makes phone calls and does it really well. People cared about both those things. People cared about music. People cared about talking to people on the phone. And Jobs said, I can make that experience a lot better. So this notion that it's supposed to be a constant companion, that you're like an air traffic controller that needs to be monitoring all these streams of information all day long, that really did came later. And it's not at all fundamental to this technology. I mean, I could imagine an alternative timeline in which the iPhone remains this sort of beautifully engineered object. It's a tool that we take out and deploy to do certain things like listen to music or get directions, and it does it really well and we like it. Like, this is great. It's a big tool, but it's not something I'm looking at all the time. This could be an alternative universe that could have happened if, let's say, the original social media companies had come across a different revenue model than an attention model. I think that's completely plausible. And so I think it's actually more arbitrary than we think, this behavior that so much of us don't like. I don't think it's just a necessary consequence of, you know, people are relatively lazy and technology is distracting. And of course, we are going to end up in a place where we have to look at these things all the time.
What would you say to somebody who uses Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat all day, but loves it? It brings them nothing but joy and they don't feel like they need any less of it. What would you say to those people?
Well, the nice thing about minimalism is that it doesn't try to identify in advance, this is bad and this is good. If there's anything I've learned watching a lot of people go through this transition process, is that one person's technological life post-minimalism looks very, very different than another's. So it never hurts to actually go through this process, because what's this process about? It's figuring out, what do I really value, and then making sure that you're using tools very intentionally to help things you really care about. So it's completely possible that you come out on the other end of such a process and you say, yeah, I'm still using all the same things. This was great. Like, this was at the core of the things I really valued, and these were the best ways to use technology to push these things I really valued. But there's a lot of people who go through this process, and though they thought beforehand, like, I like these services, I don't see it as a problem, just going through this 30-day exercise of figuring out what they really care about and trying to understand how tech could really benefit those things, they might come out and say, okay, maybe I liked being on Twitter this much, but I could be doing a lot better, right? It was fun. I didn't dislike it, but it's not helping the things that I value most of all. And so I think this shift towards intentionality in general, there's nothing lost doing it. And while it's possible that you'll end up making no changes, a lot of people are surprised to realize that there's a big gap between, is what I'm doing okay, like I'm fine with it, versus in what I'm doing, what I really want to be doing.
But at the same time, you make this a big part of the second chunk of the book is kind of better things to do or more productive things to do with your time. And you name things like, you know, reading books and going on long walks and relearning how to play the piano as these activities that people have rediscovered after pulling some of their time and attention back from social media. And this is like a trend on the internet now. Everybody is ditching their phones and picking up pottery and all this stuff. And I just wonder, like, who's to say that reading a book is better than reading Twitter? Like, part of me thinks that the answer to that is obvious, but like, is sitting in a pottery class a more valuable use of my life than talking to people on Twitter? Are we sure?
Well, so there's, for each of these things have different explanations, but there's explanations for each of them. So why is pottery class, you know, why is this suddenly something that seems so appealing? Well, what that actually goes back to is that we have this innate human drive to see our intentions made manifest in the concrete world. So this is the drive that helped us conceive of the notion that, you know, an arrowhead would be nice, and that we got a lot of fulfillment when we actually were able to make an arrowhead appear in the world. This is like this uniquely human thing that we can have complex ideas and then actually manifest those concretely in the world. So there's something special about the analog world that is sort of deep in the neurological structure of the human species. And so in that case, yeah, there is something. It's evolution that tells us that there is something in some sense better about an analog skilled hobby than digital interaction. Digital interaction has a lot of value, but our brain doesn't understand it in the same way. What about long walks? Why is that useful? Well, really what that's about is solitude. So our brain needs time alone with its own thoughts, meaning time when it's not processing inputs from other minds. So one of the big unexpected consequences of ubiquitous high-speed wireless internet access is that we can banish every moment of solitude, because every time we have some downtime, we can feed ourselves something that was created by another mind, which keeps our mind constantly in input processing mode. So if you're looking at Twitter at every down moment, your mind is constantly processing input generated from another mind. And we have a lot of evidence that that's not good.
Okay. And this is a slight aside, but can you explain to me how Abe Lincoln ended up in a book about technology? That was like the most surprising moment in the whole book, and was just a very funny thing. Like, you're talking about solitude, and you end up telling this whole story about Abe Lincoln.
Well, because Abe Lincoln's awesome.
Fair.
Yeah. So how did he
would
end
not
up?
Have well, liked Twitter, I don't think.
He probably would not have liked Twitter. Well, so Abe Lincoln has this there's this house that's actually near where I live, outside of Washington, D.C., right? And this house that used to be essentially in the countryside outside of Washington, D.C., back in Abraham Lincoln's time. Now, of course, the city has expanded to surround it. But he would retreat to this house at night, especially in the summer. After the first summer, he went here basically every day that he could in the warm weather months after he'd work at the White House. And it was this house where he could be basically alone with his family and with his thoughts. And he would roam the grounds and he would think. And he needed that time alone with his thoughts to, for example, put together his moral conviction. What do I want to do about the Civil War? He had these terrible decisions to make about is the war worth it? Should we make peace with the Confederacy? Should we push for the amendment? Should I write the Emancipation Proclamation? He probably did a lot of his reflection that ended up in the Gettysburg Address, walking the grounds of a military cemetery that was there near the house. And so this retreat that Lincoln had that got him away from the busyness and the bustle of the White House, he could go there and be alone with his own thoughts, was core for his moral development, for his self-development, and for his real insightful and decisive decision making.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, and it is one of those things I realized in reading that like I had spent that day listening to a podcast on my way to work, sitting in front of a computer, and then on Twitter, reading a book. That one's your fault. But listening to another podcast, and I had spent like approximately 0 seconds actually just sort of quietly alone with my own thoughts. And that was genuinely sort of a frightening thing that I feel like it's really easy to not notice. And maybe sort of the point is that we don't notice it as it's happening.
Right. But we're all anxious. And that's probably part of the reason why. It's really unprecedented in the history of human history, right, that we've banished every moment of solitude. I mean, it required technological miracles to make that possible. We had to build out this wireless internet, you know, grid that covers all the entire world. And we had to build these devices that could communicate with this grid and deliver information to us in our hand, anywhere we are, including in planes and in subway tunnels. I mean, it's technological miracles were necessary to try this experiment, which we're trying now, which is what if we banish every last moment of time alone with our own thoughts? And the conclusion seems to be it doesn't make us happy.
I get a sense from a lot of people, and you probably saw this in your experiment too, is that there's just this like low grade sort of unnameable anxiety that a lot of people feel and don't totally understand why. And I think that's part of the backlash on things like social media is it's like, you look at the biggest change in your life between now and a few years ago, and it's like, oh, I just spend a lot more time on Instagram and Facebook. And
yeah, and what it's pushing out seems to, mm-hmm. that's a common theme in this literature. So, you know, when I talk to people who are uneasy about technology, the argument is rarely about utility. So it's rarely what I'm doing when I look at my phone is terrible, which is different than, say, like cigarettes, right? Where a lot of smokers who don't want to be smokers say, I just wish I wasn't smoking at all. I get no benefit out of it. I'm just addicted.
Right.
That's not the case with Instagram. Right. Hey, I get value X, value Y, and value Z out of looking at it. It's not that it's a terrible experience in the moment when I'm looking at it. There are things on there that can make you unhappy, of course, but it's also what it's displacing, which is sort of the subtlety of our moment that's going on. So if it displaces all solitude and if it drastically reduces the amount of, let's say, real world analog interaction you have, that can have creep up on you. This sense of disconnection and anxiety and rootlessness. And it's hard to make the direct connection. Well, why is looking at this funny tweet on Twitter, that possibly by itself, that can't be making me sort of anxious and unhappy or this or that, because the story is a little bit more complicated. It's the displacement that's actually probably causing a lot of these issues.
And that's sort of the point, right? Is it's less about using Instagram or Facebook less just because you should, which I think is an argument worth making, but maybe not the argument that you're making. That the point is more like we're using these things instead of doing things that we would rather be doing, and they're keeping us from thinking about those things that we would rather be doing. And the point is, like, even if you want to use Instagram, use it on purpose instead of just because it's there in your pocket yelling at you all the time.
Right. So once you know what you want to be doing and you really believe that this is really important, then it's much, much easier to deal with, like, say, the technology in your life, because now you're just putting things to work for these values you really believe in. That can stick. If you come at it from the negative angle, I think I'm doing this too much, or I don't really like this, maybe I should try to do it less, that's really hard to sustain, because the next time you have a really hard week or you're stuck at the airport waiting, you know, for the 3-hour delay, then you're going to say, well, whatever. Why don't I look at this again?
So far, after reading the book twice and talking to Cal, all I've managed to do is delete social media from my phone. But even that feels like a start. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks to Cal, Tripp, Joanna, and Christopher for being here. Thanks to Tanya, our producer, and Wilson, our editor, and thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. I've been using Spotify more recently. It's actually really good. Anyway, as always, if you have feedback or ideas, please email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.